came to Rochester, it sounds like you, of course, were you born here?
I was born and raised here. My mother was born and raised here.
So that's what we'll start with. The softball, it's an easy question.
Family came here to Rochester in the 1860s.
Oh, my Lord. That's going to make a great story. All set? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm Laura Hill. Today is August 6th. I'm at the University of Rochester Rare Books and Special Collections with Mr. and Mrs. Charles and Pauline Price. So, we were just discussing where you both were born and raised.
I was born and raised in the city of Rochester.
Okay.
My mother was born and raised in the city of Rochester. She was born in 1892 here in Rochester. She attended number 3 school and West High.
Okay, and where did her people come from?
Her father came here from Virginia, but he came here in 1860.
Okay. And Mrs. Price?
Well, I was born in Philadelphia, but I came here and started school in Rochester from kindergarten to the 10th grade, and then my father decided he wanted to go back to Virginia where he was from, but made arrangements for me to go and live with an aunt in Philadelphia, and I finished the last 2 years of high school there. Graduated from West Philadelphia High School in Rochester. I went to number 3 school in West High.
Okay.
But my parents came back to Rochester, and after I graduated, I came back to Rochester, and I've been here ever since.
What brought you back to Rochester? Hmm? What brought you back to Rochester?
Well, the fact that my parents came back.
I see. I see. It wasn't this man here.
No, I didn't know him.
Really?
No.
You both went to number 3 and you both went to West High?
Yeah, but I went a number of years ahead of her.
I
went to Madison High School.
Okay, I see.
I graduated from Madison in 1942.
I see. Okay. Fantastic.
He was out of school and before I was, so I didn't know him.
So tell me a little bit about in this period, in the 40s, in the 50s, earlier back if you want to, what were race relations like in Rochester? What was going on here?
You say what's going on, what do you mean?
Well, how would you characterize the relationship between the black communities and the white communities in Rochester?
At that time in your neighborhoods, you were living in neighborhoods, and your neighbor next door was very, very close to you.
Okay.
I mean, I lived in a on Adams Street at the time, and people up the street, I'd go to her house and have dinner and everything else, and the kids that I played with would come down to my house and have dinner, or call up and say, well, I'm staying at such and such a house tonight, and that would be it, as long as you let your mother and father know where the devil you were going to be.
Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Price, did you find the same thing?
No, mine was a little bit different. I think when I was young, the neighborhood didn't have that many kids, period.
Mm-hmm.
And I played with his cousin that lives across the street from me. And then I had some friends down the street, so I never went out of the block.
Okay.
I just stayed there.
Okay.
And but then when I went into high school, we moved up on Columbia Avenue. And there weren't too many of my classmates, and actually there weren't too many young people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So I had friends, but not on the street.
Right. Was your block an integrated block?
Yes. Yeah, not that many, but there were blacks on just one side, maybe about 7 families on one side of the street, and that basically was it.
Okay.
Because we lived up near Jefferson Avenue.
Okay. And your neighborhood?
Integrated. Italians and Germans.
Okay. This is a very, very different story, of course, than what we have heard from some of the other people we interviewed who come to Rochester much later.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about the changes that took place.
I'm trying to think, when you say changes, what do you mean, you know?
Well, I mean, if you came to Rochester in the late 1950s or the late 1960s, or I'm sorry, the early 1960s, the city seemed to be much more segregated racially. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the changes that caused that. It's very different than the integrated experiences you're both describing from your childhoods.
Well, I think that was right after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people had come here to get jobs.
Okay.
And then the farming was a big industry at that time in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the farmers had made arrangements, I should say, possibly, with these different companies to bring the migrants, as they were called at that time, mm-hmm. from the south up
okay.
here. So that was a big change at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I say, farming was your big industry at that time.
Right. How do those migrants change Rochester? What kinds of changes do you see with their entrance?
Well, I think just the fact that there were more and more black people coming into Rochester, and the neighborhoods you saw more in the neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
and then they started branching out into other areas that people years ago wouldn't have been allowed to live,
mm-hmm.
but they were.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I can't really remember, but there was teachers started coming here also.
Okay.
And that was a help too.
Black teachers?
Black teachers.
Uh-huh. From the south as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Changes you saw? How do the migrants shape the city? How do they change the city?
Well, I would say that the biggest change they made was just the influx of them
mm-hmm.
coming in at a time, because they would bring them in busloads and drop them off at certain corners. It's like the, mm-hmm. and say,
wow.
Oh, we're going to pick you up at such and such a time to take you back to the farm.
Mm-hmm. So they actually lived in the city and went out to work on the...
No, they lived on the farms out.
They were
bussed in.
I see.
To the city on the weekends.
For entertainment.
That's it.
For
entertainment, buy the clothing and substantial foods, probably,
mm-hmm.
that they couldn't get out there on the farm.
I see.
And then gradually they started, getting homes in the city,
mm-hmm.
and getting jobs in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, if they had family, then sometimes their family would, well, that was with almost everybody.
Sure.
Once one person was here, then the family came.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure. So in this period, in this post-war period, what are you both doing in terms of your work life, your social life?
You mean back in the 40s you're talking about now?
Sure. In this period mm-hmm. of the migration, after the war.
Well, we still had our little club, shall we say. We had the Girls Y, which was on Clarissa Street or Caledonia Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to meet at the different Y. There was a Boys Y and a Girls Y.
Mm-hmm.
Boys Y was on Adams Street, Hubert Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to meet there.
Okay.
And have little meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you got together too many of them, I guess you'd call us antisocial now or error. But we used to have our little meetings on the weekends, and we have our parties at home.
Okay. So these were events or functions put on by the YMCA and the YWCA. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you all belong to a church?
Yes.
Both of us did. She belonged to Mount Olivet Baptist, and I belonged to the Trinity Emmanuel. Well, at that time, it was just Trinity Presbyterian Church.
Okay. And I assume these were your family's churches and... These were your family's churches, I assume.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you graduated, you said, in 1942?
Two.
And mm-hmm. then what do you do?
Uncle Sam called me.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, I graduated from Madison in 1942, and my classmates, we all thought we were the smartest boys in the world, Couldn't tell us anything. And the idea was to join the Air Force.
Okay.
Because they wouldn't call you, because there'd be a list a mile long ahead of you. And we thought, if we joined, enlisted, you wouldn't be called for maybe two or three, maybe a year anyhow.
I see.
So I graduated in June. In January, I got that little paper that says, I need you, I want you.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into service in the Army Air Corps then.
Okay. And where were you stationed?
I was stationed at Biloxi, Mississippi. They sent me from here to Biloxi, Mississippi for pre-flight training.
What was that like?
Like a new world.
I mean, you're a northern boy, born and raised, and you're sent to Mississippi. Tell me about that experience.
Well, it was a funny experience. We went up to Fort Niagara first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I actually got my first good taste of segregation in the Army, because most of my classmates were white.
Okay.
My buddies, we were all Alpha High Whys or fraternity brothers and all, and we had joined the Air Force, and we got up to Niagara Falls, and the little sergeant says, you go this way, and you go that way. And we said, wait a minute, we're all together. He says, no, you go that way, they go this way. So that was the first part of the segregation, shall I say, that I really got slapped in the face with.
Right.
And we stayed there and did our, got a, took our test and got all our shots and everything. And then we was put on a train, a little envelope, brown envelope with a red stripe around it, and we got to Cincinnati and we opened it up. They said we could open up in Cincinnati. We opened it up in Cincinnati, and all these are northern boys now. These are kids from Rochester, Syracuse, Binghamton, Elmira, Corning. Mm-hmm. They'd come here and went to Niagara Falls. And here we are. We get to Cincinnati. We open our letters and says we got to go to Biloxi, Mississippi. We darn near lost all of us. We were, whoa, what are you talking about? But we all went down there because we had enlisted. And that's when we first went down to Keesoffee, Mississippi for pre-flight training.
Okay.
And there I went to Tuskegee. When I was at Tuskegee, I was taking flying lessons and all, but I found out that one eye was stronger than the other.
Okay.
So I flunked. I couldn't fly combat, but I could fly.
Right.
And then they sent me to intelligence school from there. Well, it really was Signal Corps school, but they didn't have such things as segregated schools that you could classify as they have them nowadays.
Mm.
It was just the Army had the Army was the Army Air Corps. There was no Army Air Force or United States Air Corps, Air Force that we have today, like the Army, the Marines, and the Air Force.
Sure.
Well, there was this Army, you know, the Army Air Corps that we belonged to. So they just had the Signal Corps school, which you started out, hey, soldering the wires together and all.
Right.
But that was a lot of stuff I had. It's right here in Madison at high school, so I went through that with flying colors and went on up to be getting to crypto. And then after crypto, they just kept sending me to schools.
And did you end up overseas?
I ended up in Italy. Started in North Africa and then went to Italy.
Tell me about that.
What do you mean, tell you about? I graduated from the schools, and then they sent me to Selfridge Field, which is up near Detroit.
Okay.
And from Detroit, I was home on Christmas weekend for my first furlough I'd ever had. I was in the service, and I came home, and while I'm home, I get another telegram saying, report immediately to Norfolk, Virginia, Hampton Roads, you're being shipped out.
Okay.
So I went down to Hampton Roads and got on one of the Liberty ships, took 33 days across the Atlantic, was sick every one of the days.
Motion sick.
But here I've been raised right here in Rochester, been out on Lake Ontario, there's nothing to it. But you got on the lake and every morning you look up and you don't see anything but water.
Right.
It's kind of rough.
Sure.
And we were supposed to go into Casablanca.
Okay.
At the time, but at that time the Free French were still fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So we couldn't get into Casablanca, so we were back out in the Atlantic and then went through the Straits of Gibraltar.
Sure.
And from there went into Oran.
Okay.
And when we got to Oran, the Americans and their allies had blown up everything in the harbor. So we had to walk on planks, I would say maybe 10 to 12 inches wide, maybe two, 3 inches thick, with full fuel pack. From ship to ship, that's the only way you could get into Oran. And if your buddy in front of you with full fuel pack fell overboard, bye-bye.
Wow.
Because that was him. You're not going after him. You got a full fuel pack on your back. That's 200 pounds. And you're going after somebody else with 200 pounds, you're going to the bottom.
Sure.
So if he fell overboard, that was him.
Right.
He was gone. And we went to North Africa, and we stayed in North Africa for a while, and then we...
Where in North Africa? Do you recall?
Oran.
Oh, Oran. Okay.
Oran. As I went to the Kasbah. And from there we got our orders to go to Sicily. because we were meeting up with the 99th Pursuit Squadron, and we got to Sicily and went right through Sicily. Landed Sicily that morning, and at night we were on our way to Italy.
And so all this while, are you still working in these segregated units?
Oh yeah, segregated. At that time, it was the beginning of the 332nd Fighter Group. Mm-hmm. The 99th had already been over there. Mm-hmm. The first group of pilots that came out of Tuskegee had already been in Italy, or been in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
And we were supposed to meet up with them. And we met up with them in Sicily, but we still hadn't combined until we got to Africa, or to North Italy. We landed in Salerno. And then Salerno off to Naples. Mm-hmm. And at Naples is where we got together. And they shipped us over to Rimini Airfield, which is on the Adriatic side of the of Italy.
So are you a Tuskegee Airman? Is that what you're telling
That's
me?
That's what they're saying, yes.
Very, very interesting.
Didn't fly combat. I keep telling everybody I couldn't fly combat because of my eyes.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one of the things that comes out of World War II, I'm a history professor, of course, so you'll have to bear with me, is the double V for victory. V for victory. Victory abroad and victory at home. Was that something that mattered to you? Was that part of your consciousness about serving your country and then... the desire to have that same kind of freedom or liberty for black people in America?
I never ran across that.
Never heard that?
Mm-mm.
Okay, that's interesting. So then you do your time, you come back to the States, you come back to Rochester?
Came back to Rochester. We were on our way, when we left Italy, we was on our way to Japan.
Okay.
But when we got to the States of Gibraltar is when they dropped the first atom bomb.
Okay.
And just before we left Italy, they dropped the atom bomb. And we went through the States, they dropped the second bomb, and they detoured us from Japan to send us right to Boston.
Sure.
So we came into Boston. And that's where I got down on my hands and knees and kissed old Mother Earth, glad to be back home.
Mm-hmm.
But we came back in August, or the 1st of September, and then they shipped us from Camp Miles Standish in Massachusetts to Fort Dix.
Okay.
And that was right there at September 6th, I think, or somewhere on 5th or 6th.
Mm-hmm.
We're ready to go home. We want to go home.
Sure.
They said, you can't go home because it was VJ Day and no trains or running, nothing. Just let us out. We'll get home.
We'll walk. Sure.
But they kept us there, and I was able to get back here to Rochester on about the 7th or 8th.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you meet your bride.
No. I came back. I came back, and the funny part at that time, my father had died in August, the middle of August, anyhow, just before I left Italy.
Mm.
And they had told my mother, Red Cross, they had told my mother they had notified me. I didn't know nothing about it. I came back, and I got off the train at the New York Central Station, and I went right to where my father was working. He was working at the courthouse at that time, which is now the county office building.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in there with full pack and all these cigarettes I was going to give my father and all. Walking in there, and a lady there, Mrs. Wall, who I knew before I left. And she says, "Don't you know?" I said, "What are you talking about?" "Your father passed." I didn't even know that.
Devastating.
That was devastating. So I went from there and went home, met my mother and talked to her. And that was it when I came home.
Mm-hmm.
But then I went to work back at Kodak because when I left, I had worked at Kodak.
Okay.
So I went back to work at Kodak.
What did you do at Kodak?
Well, I started out as just as everybody else back in those days, blacks, colored, Negro, whatever area, mm-hmm. age you were in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The only jobs you could get is either running elevator,
mm-hmm.
mopping floors, or trucking, as they called it. Taking material from one machine to another.
Sure.
Even though they had a gentleman there who didn't go to the service, went to RIT, got the management degrees and salesmen and everything else there that they were teaching,
mm-hmm.
when he come back to Kodak, There was no job for him.
Right.
God bless you.
Thank you.
So I went back to Kodak, and I had played basketball, kind of an athlete, shall I say, at Madison. So I was on the basketball team there, and I said, hey, if you want me to play for you, you got to give me a better job than picking up papers off the floor and all. So
Kodak had a basketball team.
Oh, Kodak. Well, all your companies at that time had basketball teams. They were intramural company teams. It was Kodak, Hawkeye, Gleason's, all the different companies here had teams, and we'd play each other.
Okay, I've never heard that. That's fascinating.
So being playing a little basketball and could put that little ball through the hoop a little bit, they said, hey, we need you on the team.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on their team, and I told them, well, if you want me to play on your team, you know, give me a little better job than picking up papers or mopping floors.
And what did they do?
Well, they gave me a job in an experimental lab.
Experimental lab.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Well, we'd go around and the painting that they used to put on the covers of the front of the cameras, Molson paint that they used to put on, used to peel, and our job was to find out what caused it to peel.
Okay.
So we were experimenting with different types of paint and lacquers and all to put on that so it would adhere and also hold up too.
Did you figure it out?
They did, yeah. We figured it out. We got it down on the Brownie camera, the old Brownie camera.
Mm-hmm.
So we got that down, but then one night, as I told you, we used to meet at these different, the YW or YMCA,
mm-hmm.
and we was having our little meeting there. The boys and girls were sitting around getting ready for a dance and all. And a gentleman by the name of Howard Coles, which I knew from way back, my mother used to talk about, she remembered when he came to Rochester.
Sure.
So I knew Howard from way back. And he came in and said that the Rochester Police Department wouldn't take colored on the police department. Well, most of us who were living were there at that meeting were kids who had went to school here in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
And you're crazy. You're sure they would. Well,
year is this?
This is 1941.
Okay.
Well, no, I'm taking it back. It's 1947.
Because
I'd been back from service, yeah.
Okay.
And we were sitting around, and he said they wouldn't take us, and we said, oh, you're full of crazy. This is Rochester, it's our hometown. We know what they can do. So there was about four of us there. We all went down and took the exam.
Mm-hmm.
And stupid me, had to be the one to pass it.
Mm-hmm.
There was another gentleman named Lloyd Walker passed it, too. But Lloyd went on and worked for C.P. Ward. But I said, okay, I'll take the exam. So I took it and passed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they called me and said, hey, it was December of 47. December 48, I think it was. They called, said that you're appointed. I'm appointed, okay. So I went down to City Hall, and funny thing again, you know, you figure you're going to be appointed with the rest of the group, you're by yourself.
Okay.
One man.
Why?
One guy, we swear you in.
Why?
You have to ask the city fathers that.
Okay.
So I went over and then went over to the police station. They gave me my gun, club, and handcuffs, and said, you're a policeman.
That was it.
That was it.
No training.
No. Nothing in those days.
Okay.
It was 47, yeah, 1947.
Okay.
And they told me there were two detectives were meeting in the New York Central Station. Be in New York Central Station 7 o'clock, such as a night. Be there. They'll pick you up and they'll tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Said dress casual, or incognito, like they always say. I just put on an old shirt and I went down to the York Central Station. I'm sitting there and I see these two guys walking up and down. I said, oh, I know they're detectives. I know that. But they don't know who I am.
Right.
And I'm just sitting there waiting for them. And after about a half hour or so of them walking around, I said, you guys looking for me? You Charlie Price? I said, yep.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny part was about at least, well, maybe a month ahead of time, there was a shooting at the old palace Century Theater.
Okay.
And who got shot by the name of, last name was Price. So everybody thought it was me.
It was you. That's fantastic.
And, well, anyhow, these detectives told me I'm supposed to walk down in Joseph Avenue and try to find the after-hour joints and all. Oh, heck, I'm born and raised here. I knew everybody. Everybody knew me. You know, I mean...
Yeah, there was no incognito.
No. You walk in, hi, Charlie.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, I guess I'm very curious then. How were you received?
In the police department?
In the police department.
The younger fellows who I came on with, mm-hmm. Fellows who came on in 47, 48, there, 49, great, because most of us had been, were service people.
I see.
And we had the experience of depending on each other.
Mm-hmm.
The older fellows, yes, there was that feeling, who's these young whippersnappers, even to the young white fellows.
Mm-hmm.
But here's this one colored fellow.
Right.
And that was, I was the only one.
Right.
So that was the that was that feeling, because they had, years ago, there's the old way of the police department, as you should know, they did what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little feeling there.
How was that feeling expressed to you? Were there particular incidents that you remember?
Well, they would use the N-word.
Okay.
And think nothing of it.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about the women and think nothing of it.
Mm. Yeah.
Because that was their way of life at that time.
Right. Now, when do you all get married?
1952.
Okay. So he was a police
officer?
Well, I was a
policeman for about 4 years before when I met her. Mm-hmm. Well, I met her before.
Well, I met him the year in 48.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did you meet him? Mm-hmm. How did you meet him?
Well, I came back from Philadelphia, and where I was staying, he had a mutual friend that was there.
Buddy.
And so that's how I met him.
One of my buddies. Okay. Living at the same house.
Okay. So you knew what you were getting into?
Not really.
Okay.
No, I didn't know a thing.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's worked out very well.
See, then in those days, we worked 7 days and your eighth day was off.
I see.
So every seventh week, you had a Saturday and Sunday off.
I see.
The other times, you'd all have a day during a week off.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I can honestly say I dreaded the day I had off. I
really?
Liked the police department so much.
Why?
I don't know. It was a challenge.
Okay.
It's something I was doing, and it was just a challenge to me.
Mm-hmm. Were you... How were you used in the police department? And so by this I mean, what kinds of tasks were you given? What kind of spaces were you put in? How did your early years on the force work? How does that translate?
Well, I to my feelings, I was treated just like any of the other younger fellows coming on.
Mm-hmm.
When I first went on, as I said, they put me in the Joseph Avenue area, which was the 7th Ward. We used to call it the gut.
Okay.
So there's where I had to work. Mm-hmm. I worked there for about 4 years before they had a change of policies and all. And they had split the different, instead of having the precincts, they went to areas.
Okay.
So I was put in from the east side. I went to the west side.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked out of headquarters office. So now I'm working... downtown.
Mm-hmm.
When I say downtown, I work at the Main and State.
Okay.
So I had the Main and State beat, but I had Front Street,
mm-hmm.
the old Front Street.
Mm-hmm.
I used to love to work Front Street.
Why?
It was another thing, it was a challenge. The gentlemen and ladies who were in on Front Street at that time, sure, some of them were down and outers, as they used to call them.
Sure.
But we had good people there.
Mm-hmm.
I had doctors and lawyers who were alcoholics, as they were called at that time, probably today. And I'd know when they'd come down, and I'd look out for them. And when I felt that they if I had enough, I'd call their parents if they lived out in East Rochester, or Rochester, where call them and coming down and get them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did the communities accept you as an officer? I mean, you. On the one hand, you're dealing with the police force, but how does the community see a black officer?
Well, it depends on where you was working.
Okay.
Down in on the 7th Ward, I had my ups and downs, but I had very good ups.
Okay.
Most of the people there, I knew them, and they respected me.
Mm-hmm.
And I respected them. When I worked at the corner of Main and State and Front Street, the guys down there, I got to know them, and they got to know me,
mm-hmm.
businessmen and all. No problems. There'll be maybe some problems at the corner of Main and State sometime.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, I was treated very well, both by the police and the constituents or the people in the city of Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of different instances we had, even when I was working in the 7th Ward, where a couple of young kids came down and called me out my name and all. But
and by that, you mean the N-word?
Yeah, I am.
Mm-hmm.
And they would disrespect me, but I remember old Captain Leary grabbed him and brought him back and made him apologize to me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Captain Leary was the biggest guy in the world at that time, you know?
Right, right.
I felt real good about that. But then I did have experience where when I was moving up in the police department, I'll put it that way,
mm-hmm.
I got to be a plainclothesman. I was working with the youth because I always did like working with kids and all.
Sure.
And I was working with the youth, and we used to get these calls of these people say kids are doing this or that in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go out to investigate it.
Who would call you?
A citizen would call and say, hey, these kids are out here throwing stones or throwing
mm-hmm.
peaches or fruit at my house or something.
Sure.
Or they're running up and down the street and all.
Mm-hmm.
I could remember going to a house and knocking on the door and no answer. You go back to the car and say, do you got the right number? And they tell me, yes, it was that number. I said, okay. And I sat there for a while and they call me again. They said, hey, did you go to that house? Because the woman's calling again. Just these kids are bothering her and no policeman has been here. I go to the door and knock again, you know. I could see somebody moving around in here, but they wouldn't come to the front door.
What's this black man doing at my
door? No, door, knocking on their front door.
There's not a policeman here. There's a black man here.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yes, I thought I was dressed right. I had white shirt, tie on and all.
Mm-hmm.
And
not a uniform.
But I'm knocking at the door. Finally, I said, when they came over the third time over there, I said, you tell that person inside that the policeman's been at the door twice. If she doesn't want to answer the door, shame on her.
Right.
So I went back and she said, go around. I said, no, this is the front door. If you want me, here I am.
She wanted you to go to the
back door.
Door.
Mm-hmm. So I said, she finally opened the door and I explained to her what, you know, I was here to help her.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we got along good, but that image.
Right.
It was not there at the time.
Sure, sure. So we move through the 50s. We have these migrants coming in. You're noticing changes in the city. Tell me what your understanding of the civil rights movement was. Were you all involved? Would you consider yourselves activists in that period?
In what period?
Well, I mean, I guess I would say the late 50s, the early 60s, before the riot in 1964. How did you understand civil rights? Did that touch your world at all?
It touched the world, our area world. Because it was still this time that, as I said, I had a couple of good friends who went away to college. And they went down to Hampton Institute. Well, at that college, it was called Hampton Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And they graduated as an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
But he came back here to Rochester to work. Mm-mm. You can't be an engineer at our place. No, no.
Right.
But that, I would say, was the slap in the face. And I think this is what's going to happen in the world today, right now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of kids are graduating from colleges. But with this computerized world, electronic world, a lot of the jobs are gone.
Right.
Now, they're looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
What used to take 5 people to do now is done by a computer in 5 seconds.
Right, sure.
So when you get trained for a position or a job and you go to get it and there's nothing there for you, what are you going to do?
So are you suggesting that the lack of jobs, though people were qualified, led to a civil rights movement here?
I think the jobs were available to, and it was open for people, but not for black people at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Just that was the big thing. There were jobs, a lot of good opportunities.
Sure.
But the status quo didn't want to let them in.
Mm-hmm.
Because they figured they get their toe in, they're going to get their foot in, and they're going to lay in, and
taking
my job.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Everybody wants to protect their own little area or their interests and say, this is mine and I'm not going to let anybody take it.
Right. Mrs. Price, were you aware of the civil rights movement?
Yes, but not as much as he was.
Okay.
You know, I knew some of these things that went on and some of them I didn't because I, you know, was kind of secluded and go to work and come home, go to work and come home, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
And but you knew that there were issues, because I know there was a couple of females that wanted to get an apartment and in this area, and they couldn't. So, you know, things like that. And even the jobs, like at Kodak, you might get a factory job, but it was very hard to get an office job.
Right.
Because I worked at Kodak. I worked at the YWCA doing office work.
Okay.
And then I went to Kodak and applied for an office job.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a factory job.
Okay.
And then the next thing I know, this one that was working next to me who had never had any office training, she got the job.
She's a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that kind of thing.
Right.
But I mean, you know, I wasn't involved in a lot of that type of thing like he might have been in other people because my world, I didn't go out that much in different places.
Right. What kind of recourses were there in Rochester for people like these two women who tried to get an apartment and were denied, or somebody trying to get a job at Kodak and is denied? Where could they go? What could they do?
Very little at the time. We had the NAACP here and all, which I belonged to at that time, and things like that. But they could go just so far, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even they were possibly ministers and doctors. We had Dr. Munster and Dr. Levy and them.
Yeah.
They could go forward, but how far could they go? They could go to the people and make a big noise about it, but yeah, we'll take care of it and put it on the second shelf. Later on, that's as far as it would go.
Sure.
And I think, too, that people, black people realized the limitations. So a lot of times they didn't go beyond it like they would go today, you know.
Mm.
I know I can't live over here, so why even bother to try to get a house over here?
I see.
You know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What was the big story about Dr. Lindsay?
Yeah, Dr. Lindsay, he was a dentist. And I think it was Arnett Boulevard.
It was Arnett Boulevard.
And there were no blacks up in that area.
The other side of Thurston Road now.
Okay.
He bought the property and had a house built. And the people there thought that he was the chauffeur and that his wife was the maid of the people that were building the house.
I see.
And then when they found out who was building the house, it was too late for them to do anything about it.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And I found out later that one of the big people who was fighting him was one of the big men on the Rochester Police Department.
Tell me about that.
No, I tell your name.
Oh, no, no. You don't need to name names, but what does that do then?
I just found out. I said, now I know.
I see.
So you can find out a lot of things. And sometimes you let them go, and sometimes you kind of slip it to them a little bit. Well, remember you said such and such? Huh? How'd you know that?
Mm-hmm.
I have a good philosophy.
What is it?
That is, you can't beat them from the outside.
Okay.
You got to join them and beat them from the inside out.
Okay.
So you find out how they work, and then beat them from the inside out.
Once you're inside, how do you beat them?
What do? You sit there and you listen, and you learn.
Mm-hmm.
You find out, well, wait a minute, they said they did such and such and such thing. They did it this way. So now when it comes up your turn to do it, you say, well, wait a minute now. You remember back and so and so, you did it this way. Why can't we do it the same thing now? Wait a minute now, you did it the other day. We can do it now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get them that way.
Okay. So you, at this time, are on the police force, and you are also a member of the NAACP. Did that ever cause conflict for you?
No.
Okay. So then tell me, when Rochester becomes embroiled in these police brutality cases, Rufus Farewell, A.C. White...
That's the name I was trying to remember the other day.
The... I'm not as familiar with it, but a Faison case.
Faison.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, of course, the Black Muslim case. Tell me how you are juggling those two positions as a member of the NAACP who's fighting those battles, and then as a member of the police force.
Well, you have to treat people as you want to be treated yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now, some of the Muslims, as you say, I knew them well. I could talk to them.
Okay. Who were those Muslims?
Well... What was it, Muhammad, I can't even think of his name right now. This goes way back now, because he was up at Attica. He got out of Attica and he came here to Rochester and all.
Mm-hmm.
And even with Malcolm X. I mean, at the time I really got to know him, because I had studied him before he got to be Malcolm X, when he was, Little was his
mm-hmm.
name.
Malcolm Little, sure.
Yeah, and he was from Arkansas, because I had done a little of my own history running before you have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can talk to people intelligently, shall I say.
Mm-hmm.
And I had did a little red background on him, Big Red, he was called and all, so I knew all this. So when we sat down to talk as Malcolm X, he knew what I knew and I knew what he knew, and we could sit down and talk. But that time, see, I'd already been moved up to, I'd moved up in the police department, I was a captain now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in charge. I'm telling people what to do and where to go.
Okay.
So I could go and sit and talk with him.
Okay.
And I was with him the night he left to Rochester and went to New York City. Two nights later, he was killed.
Sure.
See, so I knew him way back.
I'm just dying to fire the questions at you now, of course. So if we can just go back a little, why does the Black Muslim case become the Black Muslim case in Rochester? So what I'm referring to, of course, are the night, I think it's January 6, 1963, two officers go to the Muslim mosque and they have an anonymous report that there's a man with a gun.
D'Angelo.
Yeah, of course. I'm jogging your memory now. Why?
I was an intelligence part of the police department at the time, that's why I knew about it.
Then tell me about it.
No, I knew that they were going there to the house, had surveillance on it, but I didn't know that they were going to try to force their way in.
Mm-hmm.
And as I told them, I tell the guys, even today, even when I was a captain, I said, now look, I said, remember this thing I told you about joining? All right, now, if I used to tell them, all right, now, are you going to a Catholic church tonight? Are you going in that Catholic church and go up and grab the priest? Well, no, wait a minute, it's the same thing. This Muslim is an imam.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go in the Baptist church or do you go in the Catholic church? Do you go in any church and just grab somebody? Even though he's wanted, there's other ways that you can make the arrest.
Right. Why was the mosque under surveillance?
Because nobody knew anything that what Muslim was about. It was a scary thing.
Okay. Did you think it was a scary thing?
No, because I knew the guys.
Okay.
I knew Muslims. I knew that I shouldn't say that. I knew the fellows, but I didn't know the complete rundown of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you see, it was new.
Sure.
See? And just like at the prison up at Attica.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for years... Penitentiary, any of prisons, on Friday they serve fish. Why? Because the Catholics had said they cannot eat meat on Friday. Is that right?
Right.
So they didn't serve meat on Friday. They serve fish. So now here the Muslims say, we can't eat pork. Oh, yes, you can. Here it is. You got to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
We cooked it. You got to eat it. Wait a minute. What's the difference now? Is there something wrong here? Are we looking at something different? If you don't serve fish meat on Friday, then you don't serve pork to them. But sure. That was the thing. You've got to get through this stratus, this bullheadness, shall I say, that this is what we've been doing for years. Mm-hmm. You do what we say.
Mm-hmm. So, in your estimation, the mosque is under surveillance because people were scared.
You say people. I got to say the establishment, should we say, was scared.
Okay.
We didn't know. It was new. This is something new. Like today, we got new things in this gang things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching TV the other night. And it was talking about the Spanish gangs in the different prisons now.
Sure.
And how they communicate back and forth. I was very intrigued with it.
Mm.
And I said, well, hey, that's kind of tight. Because if you don't know what's going on, you don't speak the language, it's scary.
Sure. So, again, the two officers decide on their own they're going to force their way in. And then what happens?
So you tell the guys wouldn't let them in. Said, you can't go up. Well, you have to go upstairs. You can go up the stairs to get into the mosque. You have to go to the old World Theater. Mm-hmm. And they said no.
Had there been anything in the surveillance up until that point that indicated the mosque needed to be entered?
That I cannot say positively.
Okay.
Even if they had something in the mosque, let's say there was a gun in there.
Mm-hmm. No law against that.
Yeah. Can you go in? Do you go in the church because there's a gun in the church, or do you go get a warrant?
Right.
And go try it.
Right.
So there's legal ways and there's ways that you know. Hey, we're right. We're going to do what we want to do.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So around the same time, I mentioned the Rufus Farewell case is happening.
Oh, Farewell on Plymouth Avenue.
Yep. I've been reading a lot about that. The A.C. White case. What is that doing to the police force at that time? I mean, these are very, very public cases. They're in the newspapers on a regular basis. How is the police force responding to these charges of police brutality?
Well, back in, A.C. White and Farewell, I just come out from those at Plymouth Avenue.
So
they did their investigation of it, but I couldn't say what the complete story what went on at that time.
Well, Farewell, of course, is he's severely beaten. He ends up with a couple of broken vertebrae. And that case ends up going to the Justice Department. I mean, it's one of the first times.
And that went just so far.
Yeah. Tell me. how does that all affect the police force?
How would you say? It empowered them more because it didn't go any farther.
Okay. Okay, so they were able to stop it.
Not the police. I don't know who stopped it, but it went just so far to stop it. Because I think he settled, but he settled out of court with a monetary thing. But he could have really went farther on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, I mean, I think one of the things that comes out of the A.C. White case, of course, are the massive protests and the rallying for a police review board. The NAACP is fairly involved. There's a meeting at the Baden Street Settlement.
Urban League was involved there, too.
Urban League. Well, Urban League comes later, right? They're after the riots in 65.
Yeah,
CORE is involved. There's...
SNCC.
Mm-hmm. Ministers are involved. You know, it seems there's a city council meeting to have a hearing about this police review board. What did you think about the idea of a police review board?
They never bothered me that much.
Okay.
Because I'm under the thing, if you do your job right, you don't have anything to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
If you make a mistake, admit it and say, hey, okay, we made a mistake. We won't do that again.
Mm-hmm.
But then now you got to go to some of them right off the bat. You don't deny anything right off the bat until you look into it and find out.
Were there people on the force that had something to fear from the police review board?
Maybe maybe some by myself, a few, yeah. Mm-hmm. You admit that. But most of them, no. Because I say, if you do your job, you don't have to worry about anybody reviewing yourself. Mm-hmm. If I say, I was in charge of internal affairs for years, and I used to always tell the folks, tell me the truth, and we can work around it. But if you lie to me,
right.
What can I can't help you.
Right.
So you're going to make mistakes. You're going to be hot-headed. You're human.
Mm-hmm.
What you're going through, I've probably gone through it. Because I can remember standing in the corner of Main Estate and a woman spitting at me, spitting all that in front of me. Now, I could get mad and punch her and everything else, but what would that look like in the papers the next morning, right? You have to learn to subdue your passions, shall we say.
Right. In these cases where police brutality was charged, was it frequently the same officers that were being charged, that were being accused, I should say?
I can't answer that definitely. As I say, I was in charge. I set up a program one time to find out. Computers were just starting.
Sure.
And I said, well, what I want to do, I want to give me the age of the police officer, the height of the police officer, the weight of the police officer, and the number of years that you've been in the department.
Mm-hmm.
And then every case that comes in, put this down so we can calculate it and see if it's there. Because there's always a story that they always say, the little guy is the one who the little dog always makes the most noise.
Right, the Napoleon complex.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. See? So I wanted to see if this was a theory or was it true.
Okay.
I got fought with it. I mean, no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. All right. But I never could figure that one out.
Okay.
You asked me, certain officers' names came up every time. It depends on the area where they're working.
Okay.
If they're working in an active area, you're going to have complaints, period.
Sure. Well, I mean, I have heard anecdotes where there were certain officers who could work those areas with absolutely no problem.
Sure.
You know, I've spoken to a number of people who've said, we knew who we could talk to, we knew who we could count on, and we knew who to avoid at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm making an assumption that that was also common knowledge in the police force.
I would say that's a true statement.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Coming to college, you know, there's one professor, you know, nobody wants to say, hey, that professor, he's tough.
Right.
You know, so we're going to avoid him. I want to take another course.
Right.
Or if some of this course is being taught by another professor, I'll take that professor. I don't want to go through him because he's a tough one.
Sure.
So it's human.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Price, do you remember the police review board? Do you remember when the police review board was an issue?
Not really. I didn't get that involved.
Okay.
Well, she's mad at me now because a lot of stuff I did, and she says, you never told me that.
Uh-huh.
It's one that years later you hear about it.
Sure.
But at the time, you didn't hear.
Sure.
You know,
I never brought my work home.
No, you never did.
Okay. You know, it's interesting to be a researcher and to read these newspaper accounts. I mean, it's splashed across the DNC. The Times Union is putting out special editions, and you know, and then you talk to folks and they say, yeah, I didn't even have any idea it was going on. It's hard to get a sense of how significant an event was in a community like Rochester.
Yeah.
I can remember doing the riots. I'm on Joseph Avenue. Get a call that they're breaking in the store.
Okay.
They're stealing this, they're taking this out the front door, blah, 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 and everything else. I'm sitting with another officer in the car, and I'm looking and says, that's the store. Nobody's there. Comes over the air again. That's good. I call in, I says, who's getting this report? Who's getting it? It was a newspaper reporter. So I know him. So I get up, go over to the phone, because back in those days now, we didn't have the cell phone. No,
sure.
No such thing. You know, you got to go to find one of these phones and dial the number.
Mm-hmm.
So I call him, and I says, hey, where are you getting your information from? Hold a break. I says, I'm sitting right across the street. I'm looking at the store right now. today we are best of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk to him all the time. Every time we have a meeting or it comes up with a on the riots, he's there and he says, "Don't talk about our story, child." But this is what happens. I mean,
sure.
Somebody calls in, let's just make a big story out of this. And it's the same thing in writing. Mm-hmm. Who is the best person who can write? What is their verbiage? They got good verbiage that they can write a big,
sure.
Out of one word, they can make a paragraph.
Sure.
So that's how I go with reporters.
Yeah. I want to get to the riots. But before we do, you had mentioned conversations you had with Malcolm X. How did you come to know him?
Well, my job was at that time when I got really got to know him was my job was to protect notoriety people, shall we say, mm-hmm. who come to the city of Rochester.
Sure.
I had Dr. King's father, Malcolm X, one of the two brothers who were from SNCC. Can't think of the two brothers, but both reverends.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. SNCC or SCLC?
SCLC.
Andrew Young and James Bevel.
No, they were bigger ones. These are the ones that came here to Rochester and
okay.
set up a. They got a home, apartment house named for them over on Brunson Avenue now, McCree Boulevard. I'm sorry. They changed the name. I tell people Brunson Avenue.
They don't know.
No, I don't. They don't.
Okay.
That's all I know is Brunson Avenue.
Okay, sure.
But I can't think of their names right now.
So you're assigned to these.
Yes, my job is that they come to Rochester, do their little thing, and go home
okay.
safe.
Okay.
And I had Bobby Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Who else was over? Nixon. Can't think of someone. So many of them, I can't even keep
sure.
up with. I'll never forget the one of Bobby Kennedy. The guy said I turned white that night.
You did? How come?
Well, I had planned the whole setup, where he was going to make a speech, how he was going to go in, leave, what car he was going to be in, what route we're going to take to go back to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
So we left this one area, and we're coming down Main Street. And we're going down Main Street, and I said, now, the route was to go down Main Street to Chalet Avenue, and I'll get to the airport.
Sure.
I'm in the lead car.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everything's going good. And I'm going down Plymouth. And just as we pass Plymouth Avenue, I get down towards Washington Street. And I said, where's the rest of the crew? Look behind me. They had turned at Plymouth Avenue and went down Plymouth Avenue and went to Immaculate Conception. Where there was, they had already planned this, shall we say...
Detour?
Detour. It had been planned by these other people, not unbeknowing to me.
Bobby Kennedy's people.
No, Rochester people for Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby knew about it and all, too.
I see.
But I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know. So I'm going down Main Street. The group that's behind me with Bobby Kennedy, they turned down Plymouth Avenue. And I'm going down Main Street. Whoa! I make a complete circle, come back, get down to Plymouth Avenue. He gets in an open car now. He's standing up in an open car addressing this mob of people in front of the Immaculate Conception.
Of course, Immaculate Conception is the Catholic Church.
Yeah, the Catholic Church right
mm-hmm.
there on Plymouth Avenue.
Sure.
And there's all these colored people are there. I know nothing of this. And the guy who planted, he always kids me to the day, he's still alive. He says, boy, you should have seen your face. I says, you don't know how I felt. I was going to kill you.
Who plans this?
Huh?
Who plans this?
The people who were pushing Bobby Kennedy at the time here in Rochester, the Democratic Party.
Okay.
Was pushing, but the lead person who set it up, set this up.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to mention his name.
Okay, fair enough.
But he knows and I know.
Uh-huh.
And he kids me today about it.
Sure. So you, God, that's a great story.
Yeah, story. Oh, I got another name for it.
So, yeah. So, you are then assigned to Malcolm. When does he start getting people assigned to him? Because he comes a number of times. He comes in 62, and he speaks at the University of Rochester.
I got a picture of that.
Does he have people then?
What do you mean he has people?
I mean, are people assigned to him to protect him?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Every time he came to Rochester, he went to the Covey Divinity School.
Right.
I got pictures of that.
And you are present at these events?
Oh, I'm present.
Tell me what he's saying. Tell me how people are responding.
Everybody's responding. He was a very good person to listen to. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's here. And he could present himself very well.
Of course.
See? And some of the things he was saying were true, but you had to kind of sit back and really listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just wanted to say, well, he said so-and-so, and then grab that first sentence and forget it, yes, maybe some of the things were a little out of line.
Mm-hmm.
But if you listen to him all the way down the line, he's telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, Malcolm X was a very good, I'll never forget the time the FBI came to talk to me about him after he got killed.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the best of friends, the FBI, the gentleman who came in. But that morning when he came in to see me, he says, Captain Price, so-and-so, wait a minute now. We've been buddy-buddy for I don't know how long. You know, okay. He said, well, I get very kind of, I don't remember nothing. I don't know nothing. If you want to treat me this way,
right.
You know, I don't know nothing.
Right. I understand. Do we need to break? Okay.
Do I get water?
Absolutely. Please, please. That's what it's there for.
I know that.
Help yourself. You have some as well, Mrs. Price, if you're interested. I have to tell you as an aside, I was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X last night. I've read it before. I was simply supposed to be skimming it for material, details, things I needed to get down. And there I am, you know, 10 o'clock at night, and I'm reading word for word. He sucks you in. I was sucked right back in. Material I've read over and over, and I start to laugh at myself when I realize what I was doing. You know, I'm spending all this time that I honestly don't have, because he has that way of drawing you. I mean, you want to know what's coming next. You want to know where he's going, and I'm amazed by his ability.
Well, he's one of the leader here in Rochester now of the Muslim group. I've known him when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you.
No.
I was speaking to Goldstein Small this morning.
That's familiar name.
Well, it should be. Goldstein Small was one of the two Muslims that were arrested that night in 63 when the officers forced their way through. Goldstein Small and Freddie Thomas were the two.
Oh, I know Freddie.
Mm-hmm. Were the two men. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, Mr. Small was telling me that a man named Ray Ray Shabazz.
That's the one. That was the one who I started, Shabazz.
Okay, good.
I got his picture on home.
Well, if you have Mr. Goldstein or Goldstein Small was trying to get some contact information for me for him. So if you have a contact, I would love to talk to him. Anyhow.
Shabazz, it's a name I forgot.
Ray Ray Shabazz, yep.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to ask, you are assigned to Malcolm X. Tell me about the conversations you were having with him. What was that exchange like? Did he want you to become a Muslim?
No and yes.
Okay.
But, you know, he knew that I told him one time, I said, now, you know, I'm a Presbyterian. And he says, all right, and you know, he started doing it. But the, you say, he draws you in.
Mm-hmm.
The way he would talk to you and all, you're starting to lean until you can say, whoa, I'm getting to that edge, get me back, let's get back, you know?
Sure.
But that's the way he was.
Sure.
That's what we said, remember that night up in the old Mango Hotel? We had both taken our shoes off. We were sitting there just talking back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like two gentlemen just sitting there talking. That's all.
Sure.
Just saying, well, what about this? What about that? And that was it. None of this your political ramifications or pushing on anybody. It was just sitting, talking back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I left that night and went home. Best I left Irv there that night. And the next morning I picked him up and took him to the airport. See ya.
Yeah.
Okay, Malcolm. And two nights later, he's killed.
And that's in 65,
in New York City.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. How frequently was he in Rochester?
I would say at least four or five times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at least that. Because when he first came here, nobody knew him. He was Big Red. And then he came to RIT, he came to Colgate, and he came to U of R here.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was called back one more, another time he was here, too.
Cornhill Methodist. That's the
yeah,
same.
That's on,
the same trip as the Colgate trip, I think.
Yeah, they were two together.
Mm-hmm. So the FBI is very interested in what he's doing in Rochester.
Oh, yeah, they were interested in, well, did we know what happened? We had to, I think the word was out that he was on a hit list, shall we put it.
Sure.
And that's why we were, when he came into Rochester the last time, that's why he had 24-hour surveillance and 24-hour service right with him.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed with him and another officer. When I went home, I assigned another officer to stay all night with him, mm-hmm. right there in the Mango Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And he stayed with him all night long. Next morning when I got there, I picked him up, took him to the airport. We had an inkling that something was going to happen. We didn't know what.
Right.
But we knew something was going to happen.
Right. How was he received in Rochester? How did black people receive him? How did white people receive him? How did the police department receive him?
Well, the police department received him in a way where our job was to protect him. So that's how we received him.
Mm-hmm.
As the people who brought him here, they were, in a way, mesmerized with him.
Okay.
And then there was the white people who wanted to know him and wanted to get it, and it was there, but they were that fear. Here's this guy who can draw people. Here's a man who can talk to people.
Yeah.
And people get riled up about what he says,
mm-hmm.
and how he says it. So there's that group that is saying, wait a minute, you know, watch yourself. What's he doing? This guy's getting too powerful. He's too big.
Right. See? Right. Okay. So I would like to move to the riots, but while we're still on Malcolm, I had the opportunity to read the report that Chief Lombard puts together after the riots. And he actually says in this report that Malcolm X came into the community, he stirred up hate, and convinced a bunch of black leaders that police brutality was the problem. And so really, Malcolm X is the reason why we have the riot. This is a small section of it. He does a very balanced job, I think, in sort of looking at the conditions. But he really saw Malcolm X as a catalyst for this. How would you respond to that?
That he was a catalyst to the riots.
Mm-hmm.
I would say he was a, I wouldn't say catalyst, but I would say how would you put it? He made people, when I say people, now I'm saying the black people, realize that they were being held down.
Mm-hmm.
That they had certain rights, that they were being denied. And a lot of people didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't say he was a catalyst for the riot. The riots was an economic, I would say, and political.
Mm-hmm.
People were tired of being denied things that they actually should have. That was their given rights. Okay? So there was a lot of stuff in the riots. Now, if you want to go to the riots, I've kind of been in a number of panels, and I just sit and listen. And some of them I say, were you there? Well, I read about it. Oh, okay. Then you know all about it. I'm not going to say any word.
Right.
I was there. Now, you can say what you want to, okay. And actually, the riots, it was a funny thing, I'll put it that way. Because, you see, I did a little research on it also, mm-hmm. on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Brooks.
Okay.
Had come to the city of Rochester, got a permit. They have Nassau Street blocked off for a block party from Nassau and Joseph to Joyner.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Brooks lived his third house in on the left. I did a house. I knew Reverend Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He's having a party. You're having a party at your house. One person comes into your house now and starts pushing things around in your house. Now, what are you going to do? You tell him to stop. Same thing he did. He went to this gentleman. He says, look, you're inebriated. You had a little few drinks.
Mm-hmm.
Cool it.
Right.
The guy that you have in your house is tearing your house up. You talk to him. He doesn't abide. So now you call the police. Reverend Brooks calls the police.
Mm-hmm.
Now the police come to your house, come to Reverend Brooks. Now what is the police supposed to do? Here's a gentleman off out of line.
Mm-hmm.
Gentleman at your house is a little off of line. Now if the police walk away and leave him in your house, you're mad. Police walk away from the riots, this gentleman down in from Reverend Brooks, his group is mad.
Sure.
So now the police are going to take him away. Going to make an arrest. Try to talk to him. You can't talk to him because he's had a few to drink.
Inebriated.
No, I will say that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to laugh. You know, on TV you always see these people being locked up. The guy puts his hands behind his back very easy, you know, and then put the handcuffs on. I have never, as long as I've been a police officer, been able to put handcuffs on a guy who just puts his hand behind his back, you know. It's impossible. If I'm going to put handcuffs on you right now today, you're not going to just say, well, put your hands behind
your back. No, it's against human nature.
That's true.
You don't want to be in bondage.
But you see this on TV, and everybody says, oh, that's the way they act. Forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to be handcuffed or arrested anyhow, right? So the gentleman gets a little riled up. So that's the beginning. In my estimation, people are, that's all. It's a hot night.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's out.
Mm-hmm.
As I stated before, the politics, the economics, and all this is still brewing.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm X has been here.
Right.
He's told these guys, people, some of the rights and all, which is true. People are a little teared. Did you say A.C. White's case has been there? Farewell case. These things are all boiling.
Mm-hmm.
They're in this pot, this stew. It's boiling. It's going to boil, and it blew.
Yeah.
But a lot of people want to say the riots were because of this arrest. Partially, okay, I'll grant you, was part of the arrest.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of other undercoat underneath of it.
Sure. Tell me a little bit about, because they have been such a presence in the record of the riots. Tell me about the police dogs.
They first said, and I did the investigation of this.
Mm-hmm.
I headed the investigation. I did a complete investigation. I just headed it. They said it was Kenneth Scott, who I knew.
They
said he was a canine officer.
Okay.
He and his dog was down there.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth Scott wasn't working that night.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody had put out this word again. Newspaper, who's got a good vocabulary and write, said there was a dog there. There was no dogs. There was no dogs there that night.
Okay.
Kenneth, funny, first said, Kenneth Scott, hey, Kenny, would you work? I wasn't even working that night. So his dog, he wasn't even there.
Mm-hmm. How does this story about the dogs, the newspapers, okay, but it's widely circulated in the community?
Oh, you got to just put that word out, honey. And it goes.
Okay.
It goes.
Then let me ask you this. Why was the community receptive to a story about dogs? I mean, you can tell a lot of stories. It doesn't excite people. But you tell a story about the dogs.
Well, this is the dogs was a problem from the beginning coming into the department.
Okay.
Because they had the dogs in and they had these demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the demonstrations were this guy with his big, you know, sort of like an arm guard,
mm-hmm.
and it shows how the dog is grabbing the arm and all.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody goes for this. Plus, what did you see in the papers of Bull Connors down in nothing but dogs?
Birmingham.
Mm-hmm. So this is in people's minds, dogs. Fire hoses was another thing.
That's right.
Where did they call the fire department down? Now, this is all in people's minds. So, hey, all you got to do is say, hey, the fire department said, well, they were there.
Right.
Well, they turned the hose on. Nobody knows it, but they turned the hose on people. That's all it takes.
So, in your recollection, the dogs were not at the riot.
They were not at the riot.
Okay, and the hoses were not used on people at the riots.
Now, the hoses, they weren't used on people at the riot. They were used to flush the streets some.
Okay.
I'll grant you that.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't use them on the people.
Okay. Okay. I mean, these are very, very important things.
Not like they showed in Birmingham.
Right. Right. What were your specific responsibilities during the riot?
I was more, as I say, I just got out of the hospital because we got, and I was in plain clothes because I'm working in the intelligence section of the police department.
Mm-hmm.
So I could walk up and down all the streets and nothing to it. I got arrested myself.
In the riot?
In the riot.
What?
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know what to say about that. For what?
I'm walking down Joseph Avenue and a state trooper says, get off the street. And I say, well, for what? Because I told you so. So I'm walking, you're under arrest. Okay. I'm not fighting you, all right?
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Take me to the station. They said, well, Charlie, what are you doing? I said, you're arresting me. It's Sergeant. Yeah, Sergeant. Yeah. Yeah. That Sergeant Price, he's walking the street. He's supposed to be down there. He's looking, was trying to find out what's going on. Trooper said, well, you didn't tell me. I said, you didn't ask me, did you? He just told me I was under arrest. I couldn't walk the street. That was another thing at the riots. Let's say, I'm trying to get a good picture here. Back in those days, we didn't...
I'm sorry, you have just thrown me for a loop. I don't even know what to say about that.
Typical.
Typical?
Typical.
Mm-hmm. Typical. Oh, it was a good time when I came back from Newark, from the riots in Newark. You picked me up at the airport?
Mm-hmm.
See, I put all different handles. I was also working for the Justice Department. I was sent down in Newark riots.
Okay.
But let's take the riots here in Rochester. Back in 64, we didn't have the beautiful air conditioning units that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
Not too many fans. Now, let's take Joseph Avenue from the bridge, railroad bridge, down to Herman Street.
Okay.
All right, houses go right up from the street, straight up. Most of them are stores.
Right.
The apartments are on the second and third floors.
Mm-hmm.
No air conditioning, right? Now they tell me, if you're sitting there and they say, you can't come out your house, go in your house. So now you go in your house and go up to the second floor. Now don't look out that window. Don't raise that window to get some air. Hey, don't open that window. You maybe going to drop something. You're going to throw something out that window. Close that window. Hey, I'm in my own house. Tell me I can't come out in the street to get air. I'm in my apartment now, and I want to open my window to let some air in. And you tell me I can't do it. Now, what am I going to do? Sit there and, like they say, don't close your car doors and leave your animal in there or your baby? But you know, human beings... You stay in the house. Close that window.
Who is saying those things? Because now you have the Rochester Police, Monroe County Sheriff, you have the State Police, the National Guard comes in. Who's running the operation at that point? I mean, you have the State Police arresting the local police. Who's running the show?
Who was running the show at that time? Lombard was the chief.
Mm-hmm.
But then we had this civil defense area man, and I can't think what his name was, the one who got killed in the airplane.
Mm.
I can't think what his name is now. And you got Skinner?
Skinner.
Yeah, Skinner was the sheriff at the time. And I don't know who was head of the state police at that time. But Lombard was the wheel, shall I say. But he had all these other people tell him, the mayor or the city manager at that time. We didn't have a mayor.
Right.
It was the city manager.
He's ceremonial.
No, it was the city manager or Frank Lamb.
It's Homer as the city manager.
Homer was the city
Porter
manager.
Homer and
Porter Homer.
Frank Lamb is
and
the
Frank
mayor.
Frank Lamb. Well, Frank Lamb and I grew up together.
Okay.
We were buddies.
Mm-hmm.
Fought like cats and dogs at each other.
Okay.
They put us in a ring and it was something.
Okay.
But actually, who was the chief, I got to say, would be Lombard.
Mm-hmm.
But he was taking his orders from whatever he got, information he could get.
Sure.
The thing was, don't let anybody open the windows because they may throw something out the window.
Yeah, sure. Bricks, cocktails.
See, anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to look on both sides of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you can't tell, you tell somebody to close the windows, but then start thinking about it. You say, well, wait a minute, how far can we go?
And so are you suggesting that once you do this, once you put the curfew out, once you force people back into their homes, once you tell them they can't open their windows, that that increases?
Certainly. Wouldn't it increase you if I tell you you
move
out here? If I say you can't go out this room, you got to stay in this room. What am I doing?
Yeah, I don't want, absolutely. I don't want to put words in your mouth, though. I want to be sure I know what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the response then creates more of the problems that come the next night.
And the response that you're giving is what you're getting firsthand, and you haven't had time to digest it all. All you got to say, hey, we got to do this now, period.
Right.
This is where the event is at the present time. And that's all you can think of at that.
Mm-hmm. So how and why do the riots end?
Cool heads. People start to realize.
People who?
Both sides.
Okay.
Start to realize that no good is coming of this.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are supposedly, and I use that word very loosely, rioting and breaking it and doing all this, they're cooling down. The police are cooling down.
Mm-hmm.
The National Guard is kind of pulled back.
Mm-hmm.
Did you tell them about Matt Crump trying to get home? The National Guard out in Cobbs Hill?
Yeah.
National Guard is bivouacked out there in Cobbs Hill.
Right.
We have now we live on Castlebar Road. I don't know if you know about Castlebar Road.
I used to live on Castlebar Road.
We live at 125, and we've lived there since 1960? Yeah, it's 1960.
I lived there for 1 year at 32 Castlebar Road.
We live 125.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw your address and I thought, oh, that's crazy.
A friend of ours at the time lived on Nunde Boulevard.
Okay.
His wife worked at Delco.
Delco.
Mm-hmm.
She worked a 3-11 shift.
Right.
So he would pick her up to bring her home at night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, getting off the expressway at Culver Road,
mm-hmm.
what do? You take that, go through the park?
Yeah, right.
Okay, but the National Guard is
there.
Bivouacked there, right? Here you are in a nice car, and you're bringing your wife home. They stop you and say, what are you doing here? Going home. Don't know N-word people live here. Now, he's been living there before us on Nunde Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
Lloyd Hirsch lived on Castlebar Road.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're bringing your wife home from work, and somebody's going to tell you, you don't live here? You can't come down this road? What are you talking about?
Right.
All right, let's take it. The National Guard doesn't know. They picked this guy, the National Guard, who came in. Maybe the guy that stopped him lives in Elmira, shall I say. How should he know who lives where and what?
Sure. Sure.
He's doing his job, but how does that feel? How do you feel when you say you can't even go home?
Mr. Price, I have to tell you, I've heard you talk tonight from both sides of the spectrum. How and what did all of this do to you? You're a black man, you're a police officer, you have friends that are being treated this way, you're being treated this way, and yet you are asked to be, you are an official of the city of Rochester. What does that do to you?
Makes you think, that's one sure thing.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you try to understand both sides of a story before you jump mm-hmm. to conclusions. Even when I was in charge, I say, of the internal affairs after I got promoted and all, and people would come in with complaints. Well, you know, the first thing is, oh, deny it. Oh, no. Wait a minute. Could be. Let's look into it first. There's always two sides of a story.
Right.
You just can't take one person's side and say, oh, that's it. You have to look at it and then make a decision. The same way with the internet. I noticed a lot of things that was going wrong. I tried to correct them. Mm-hmm. I'd bring the guys in and talk to them. Or I'd even talk to Lombard. I'd say, Bill, it's not right. This is not right. You can't do it this way. Sit down and talk about it. Well, let's see if we can come to a happy medium here. That's what you have to do.
Was the happy medium enough?
Sometimes. But there's somebody, you know, there's always the one over here that you're not going to change. I don't care what you do.
Right.
And what you say.
Right. So the riots end. And you have a fury of activity, organizations developing, people coming together. We have to do something. How did this happen to Rochester? The image is tarnished. We have to save it. On and on and on. What did you make of all that, both of you?
Can I talk for what?
No, go ahead.
What do I make of it? I mean, that the city is turning. People are starting to think. People are starting to realize, hey, this happened in Rochester. It shouldn't have happened in Rochester, but it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what can we do to correct it? Now, we've got people who are trying. And you got people who are saying, okay, we can go just so far, and that's it. I don't care what you do. We're going just so far, and that's it.
Right.
And there's others saying, hey, that's not right. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. If this city's going to survive. Same thing today, right? Things today. If you don't, the economic condition, if we don't start doing some change in there, we're going to be in a bad shape. But right. There's start people up at the top and saying, hey, this is what there's going to be, and this is the way we're going to do it. Come hell or high water.
Mm-hmm.
They like it a lot. We're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it right? Hey, I don't know. We'll have to wait and find out.
What do you make of some of the organizations that come in after the riots? So, of course, the big one is Fight.
Fight? Oh. I have no problems with Fight. I mean, the people who were in Fight it when they first started, great. Some of them were there, as I say. When they first started, were way off base, but some of them were right.
Mm-hmm. What did Fight do right?
It brought the people together.
Okay.
That's what I was going to say. I would say it brought people together. I mean, it brought people, and I say people together, it brought the people from both economic, from high economic to low economic together.
Okay.
And they're saying, hey, we're all one. We got to settle this. I mean, you had the fraternities, the sororities, the churches, the low economic group, people getting together, Action for Better Community, Urban League, all of them got mm-hmm. together, mm-hmm. working now.
We're all black. We're all in
well,
this together.
Yeah, it's that's the way of saying it that way, but
mm-hmm.
we're a human resource people.
Okay.
We're going, trying to get something done here.
Okay.
I think sometimes the bad things that happen sometimes open up the doors to good things, because before the riots, you know, black people were here, but not spread out the way they are now,
mm-hmm.
and jobs and other areas.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bad thing, but it helped in the long run.
Yeah, I would say during the riots, I talked to some of these people now, and right after the riots too, the way to express yourself was, Khrushchev, yeah, now I got to do it this way.
Sure.
That was the only way you'd get your attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a little different.
Okay.
You got to go to a person, all right, now let's sit down. Is there a way that we can settle this? What's mm-hmm. your idea? What's my idea? Let's come to a happy medium here.
Mm-hmm.
Can we sit down and talk?
Right.
Now, is something going to come of this? Or are we going to write a nice big book and let it sit on a shelf somewhere? Or are we going to take what we find here and what we discuss and put it into action?
Right. Is fight able to do that?
Fight today? No.
Fight in 1965.
No, I don't think they were able in 65 to do that because they had too many fractions.
Okay. Tell me about some of those fractions.
Well, I mean, you had too many different... You had different people in there trying to run the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
Minister Florence was running the show. Then you had some of the ministers got in there. They wanted to say, well, no, you do it this way. Then you got your elite. And you got the brainwave people telling you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ones the Harvard people, Harvard walls coming in and tell you what to do. You had Alinsky come in and tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you got too many people trying to run the show. It's not going to work.
You mentioned Alinsky. What was Alinsky's relationship to Rochester? What was his relationship to Florence?
Well, he and Florence, I think, were very close.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get to meet Paul that much. I knew of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I knew some people who knew of him in Chicago. And I kind of interviewed them to find out, hey, what kind of guy have I got here, you know?
Yeah, you're an intelligence.
Yeah, before I open my mouth, what kind of guy is it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Paul's this, he's that, and all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Art Farrell came in here from Chicago who knew him very well.
Art Farrell.
He was head of Bainsey Settlement.
Okay. And so he knew Saul Alinsky from
Chicago.
I see. He didn't like Saul Alinsky, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I can't read that man's mind, but.
Well, I think he was quite vocal about it, actually. Okay, I knew the name, but I couldn't place it. Okay, I see. So, what does the city do right after the riots? If bad things lead to good things, that change has to happen, that process has to happen. What does the city do to facilitate those changes?
Frank Lamb tried to get, he and Connie Mitchell, I think, was got together, and they tried to set up some type of programs and all. But Frank's hands were tied.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he could go just so far.
Mm-hmm. And is that because he's the mayor and the mayor doesn't have the power? Why are his hands tied?
Well, it's political.
Okay.
You've got fractions on both sides there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a Democrat. And you had the Republicans saying, oh, you know, the same thing's going on in Washington today.
Sure.
I want my little power here, too.
Sure.
But he's, as I say, Frank tried, and as I say, but he could go so far, but he made some boo-boos too.
Okay.
I told him. Oh, Charlie, I said, you goofed.
Mm-hmm.
In my sense, I don't know if in your sense, you may think you did the right thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And so at this point, are you all involved in all of it?
She is.
Okay, you kept separate churches once you were married?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's being talked about at coffee hour at Mount Olivet around all this?
Actually, you don't have that much coffee hour.
You know, I was there a couple weeks ago and I thought, why don't they have a coffee hour?
Oh, you were at Mount Olivet?
I was. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's there every day.
I think it was the week of the art festival, the Cornhill Art Festival. Oh, so it was a real small.
Yeah, we weren't. I wasn't.
Yeah, it was a small, gathering that day.
Yeah.
But what are people saying? I mean, you have your meetings. You're all discussing. What's being said?
Well, most of the meetings that I go to, I go to Bible study, and of course, that's about the Bible. And then if they have a church meeting, it's basically about what's going on in the church and what they might want to happen in the church and things like that. Mm-hmm. You don't really hear too much about anything outside. They're just focused on what's happening within the church.
And it was like that in the 60s as well?
It was a little bit different.
Whitaker. Reverend Whitaker was the minister.
Oh, yes, the Harvard man.
Yeah.
The Harvard man.
Oh. Yeah. But now it's pretty strict, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they don't really get off the beaten track too much. Whatever is going on within the church, that's what
they are concerned with.
Or what they want to go on in there.
Well, they had a very lovely baptism that day that I was there.
Oh, yeah.
Very
I wasn't
nice.
There that day.
Yeah, very nice. Mm-hmm. And so, Presbyterian, what's going on in your church in the 60s? How are they responding?
Well, to tell you the truth, I wasn't very active in my church in the 60s. Because
okay.
I was working with the police department, and I was busy. And
7 days on, one day off.
That wasn't even off. That one day wasn't even off.
Nights, too.
So, I didn't get involved that much in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to think, who was the minister at that time? Oh, Reverend Salmon.
Okay.
Reverend Salmon, Pogut left. Reverend Salmon.
Mm-hmm. What involvement, if any, did you have in any of your capacities with Colgate Divinity? Did you ever have occasion to go there? I mean, you mentioned being there with Malcolm. Oh no, what have I gotten into? You all are giggling.
I think I remember up at Colgate when they were going for the chair.
Okay.
They had their little escapade up there.
Okay.
At Colgate Divinity School.
Okay.
And the students had chained them to the doors. And
so this would
themselves.
Be the Black Student Caucus.
Yes.
Oh, please tell.
No, I don't know nothing about it.
What do you mean you don't know anything about it?
You have to talk about your friend.
No, I'm not going to talk about Dr. Sermon. He's a very good friend of mine.
Oh, please tell me what happened up there.
Well, it was funny because, as I say, I knew the minister. They were students.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know them better after. Well, while they were there, and I got to know them better after.
There's only like a handful of them, right?
Yeah.
9, 14, something?
That's all. That's about it. It was Bobby Schoser, Joe, what's the guy? He was just here a couple of weeks ago at our church. He spoke at our church. Can't think of his name now. And a number of them, but I knew some of them. And the ministers and the teachers who were there, I knew them. Reverend Jefferson and what's his name from Indiana? Marvin Chandler.
Mm.
No, let me see.
Mm-hmm.
So I.
Somebody else?
Who I'm trying to think
of?
Thurman.
Well, Thurman was a student, right?
Oh.
He was just a student.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But I knew them all, and, they had this little settee, shall I say, up there.
Mm-hmm.
And Lombard. No, who was it? Yeah, Lombard was. Is Lombard chief then or Hastings?
Gosh, I think he's not the chief anymore. Because this is late. It's 69, 68?
It had to be Hastings.
It's 68 or 69 this happened.
Yeah, Hastings. And I was working in the intelligence section then, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because they told me about that they chained them to the doors and all up there. And deputy chief, we used to call him Duke. I said, what do you got? He says, we got bolt cutters. Bolt cutters. And he had to go up there, cut these bolts, so they could get it and all. But
what?
That was something then. Ministers, as they say, the students. They weren't ministers yet. They were still students.
Mm-hmm. What did they want?
They wanted the Dr. King chair, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
The chair thing set up. Yeah, that was it.
Okay. Why did they have to take over a building in order for that
because
to happen?
Because the establishment said, no, we weren't going to do it.
Okay. I mean, and this is an institution that has a very liberal, progressive background. They're priding themselves on it.
I know. But they weren't thinking of doing it until somebody said, yes, we want it.
So the students locked themselves in this building?
Bexley Hall.
Bexley Hall, that's right. That's right.
Well, you're bringing back memories. I can't remember all this.
Mm-hmm. And the university, the seminary, agrees they're going to have a Dr. King chair.
Then it was all settled and that was it.
Hmm. Okay. I don't even know where to go now. Y'all had the giggles and I got sidetracked.
Oh, didn't tell you about it.
Tell me, Mrs. Price.
Well, Charles, Dr. Thurman and I are very close. His first name is Charles. Mm-hmm. My name is Charles. We have a good time together.
He's a minister in
Second Baptist.
Second Baptist.
Here in Rochester?
No, Mumford.
Oh, Mumford, okay.
That's the oldest black yeah. church in this area.
Yep.
But every time they see each other, Reverend Thurman gets on him like white on rice. It is so funny.
About?
Any of those things.
Well, when he was at Colgate, mm-hmm. you know, and whatever he was involved in, he just keeps reminding him.
What were you involved in?
Mm-hmm.
You don't make a very good interview subject,
well,
you know.
I've learned a long time ago.
I bet you have. If we could move away from the particulars for just a little bit, I'm sure you all must be getting tired. Can you tell me how does a police department, how does an investigative department, intelligence department, cope with these changes in the Black freedom struggle in this period? I mean, you move from, you know, this nonviolent Dr. King civil rights movement into Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, Black Power, having to cut open the doors of a seminary with bolt cutters. How do you all, as a department, cope with those changes?
I guess you have to go with the flow, I guess, as they say. Mm-hmm. But to me, I just say, well, hey, it's another era, it's another day. We had the 60s, passed. Now we got the kids here, supposed to be rioting, not rioting, but on the dope scene. Mm-hmm. And there's the gang scene. Mm-hmm. You have to cope with these problems as they come along. That's where I felt about it, anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Did people in the department, in the city, did they turn to you, Mr. Price, because you were Black? Did they think that somehow you would have a better understanding of how to cope with these problems?
In a way, some of them did. Mm-hmm. And in the other way, like I said, they had been setting their ways, and that was the way they were going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Until you just sit down and try to talk to them, explain to them, and show them that you could do it. Many times, certain instances would come up. And I'd say, no. Sit down for a minute. Just take it easy. Or they'd want to make a statement. They say, no, don't make any statement at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find out if it's true or not?
Right.
I mean, we had the problem there when James's wife, I can't see that girl's name. Jim, who's head of ABC?
McCullough.
Jim McCullough.
Mm-hmm.
When Jim McCullough's daughter got shot.
Mm.
It was a big story on that. And there was a big story about what happened at the hospital. When the daughter was brought into the hospital. And they wanted to make a statement. I said, don't make any statements. Let's find out what's true first.
Right.
And if you got something to back up what you're saying, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But just not go out here and say, oh, she did this or they did this or somebody read this. It's like I was telling you about the story of breaking in the store.
Mm-hmm.
Go check and find out first.
Right. Right. Something about you bringing up these particular incidents, I have to know. I've heard some fantastic stories about the fight election, where Bernie Gifford replaced Franklin Florence as
Bernie?
The president.
Oh, yeah.
I have heard some amazing stories about that night. Gun battles, arrests, kidnappings. I mean, all kinds of fantastic stories. Tell me.
I was not there at that time. I got to admit I was not there.
Okay.
I admit I was not there, but I heard stories too. But
mm-hmm.
Bernie Gifford, I know him well. I knew Franklin Florence well too,
mm-hmm.
both of them.
What kind of relationship?
What was the other's name? That other
Ray,
short fellow.
Ray Scott?
Well, I know Ray. Ray's still here.
Oh, Dalian McEwen.
McEwen.
Yep, McEwen.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He's a short one.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of relationships did those people have with the police department? Those presidents of fight?
Florence had a, I would say a, oh, it was not a smooth relationship, shall I say, the police department. Bernie Gifford,
mm-hmm.
yes, you could mm-hmm. sit down with Bernie. Bernie was very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
You could sit down and talk with Bernie.
Right.
McEwen, well, that was the small individual, but he was all right.
You were checking your Napoleon
yeah,
complex there.
Yeah, there you go. He was there. Who was the other one now?
Ray Scott.
Ray Scott. Now, Ray Scott was a different individual altogether.
Mm-hmm.
He was very smooth, but he was very caustic if he wanted to be.
Hmm.
He could be very caustic, but he was very smooth.
Okay.
Ray, I just saw Ray the other day. We hadn't seen each other in a long time.
How was that?
Very good. We stuck. Hey, Charlie. Hi, Ray. How you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of these things. We have, as I say, I had that relationship with him.
Right.
Now, professional-wise, Reverend Scott, just getting bright. You know, one of these things. So, but
mm-hmm.
we sat down and talked, friends.
Sure.
And, Minister Florence and I got along, but it wasn't that smooth way, shall I say.
Did they seek you out? Did they come to you in your role on the police?
Well, they would come to my office because they knew that. They'd come to my office with the complaints, if they
mm-hmm.
had the complaints. They'd come to my office and, I would say, I had a big table there and come on in, let's
mm-hmm.
sit down, let's talk
sure.
and find out what this is all about. And give me, if you got a complaint, give me the complaint, I'll handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And then give me a week or two and I'll get back to
mm-hmm.
you and tell you what, if you're right or wrong. And
sure.
if you're, I many times I came back to Reverend Florence and told me, no, you were wrong. But that didn't hit him. It was him.
Right.
But the other ones, I could come back and explain to them, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we didn't know this.
Right.
Well, they said this, but here's, let's go by a time schedule,
mm-hmm.
which we had down and all.
Right. Right.
Now, could this happen within this span?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, it couldn't. Well.
Did the police department feel the need to keep intelligence on fight?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I've got to say that. Because you ought to know what's going on in your city. And especially if you're going to be patrolling it, you got to know what's going on.
Right.
Because you got to pass that information on down to your commanders.
Mm-hmm.
Let them know what's going on. That's the way I felt.
Right.
And I'd be, if I was, when I was commander, as I say, I was commander of Genesee section. I want to know what's going on in my area so I can let my troops, the guys who I work for me, let them know what's going on. You have to have that up and down communication.
Mm-hmm. In broad form, I'm not asking for specifics, but in broad form, how do you go about, in any situation, gathering that intelligence?
By knowing people.
Okay.
And knowing the area, too.
Mm-hmm.
I could sit at my desk and get on the phone and call somebody and find out if a complaint, I can call, hey, Charlie Price, what's going on? Oh, Charlie, so-and-so. Well, wait a minute now. The guy said, oh, he's way off base. This is what happened, so-and-so. You can't, don't tell him about it, but this is what happened. Don't worry about it. It's all taken care of.
One of the things that I have been able to sort of glean from these interviews that I've done is that there were incredible informal networks throughout the community. You know, I'll tell you, Daryl Porter relayed a story where he would find himself in a situation where there was about to be a gang fight, and he knew they were going to lose. So rather than not face it, he would call Connie Mitchell and say, you need to get the police here at this time, so on and so forth.
Oh, that's right, man.
And then Connie Mitchell would call, Lord knows, but that these information networks, these informal networks, were the heart of the community.
It's the same thing even with the riots at Attica.
Tell me about that.
A very good friend of mine. They wouldn't let me go up there. But a very good friend of mine went up there, and we'd sit down and talk. When he'd come back, he'd talk to me at night about it. Mm-hmm. I'd tell him, okay, blah, blah, blah. And next morning, I'd be at work. And I knew what was going to go on the next day.
Right. Sure.
But that's the information that goes on. But I have to laugh. You know, I shouldn't say laugh, but Daryl Porter, if he was 12 to 13 years old, the riots were lucky.
Yeah.
If he was that old. Yeah. And I've known him since he was a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I always said, Daryl, I'm going to stop your noise. I said, you were nothing but a little baby, for God's sake, when this went on. Now you're telling everybody, because we've been on panels together.
Sure.
And I said, now you're telling all these people about what you did and all this. Can you imagine a 13-year-old, a 12, 13-year-old guy telling these teenagers or 19 or 20-year-old guys what to do? Can you imagine that?
Right.
And I said, no, sure, you were 12 to 13, there's a store open that this boy could into, and you see, sure, you're going to go in and grab a shirt. What teenager isn't going to do it? You don't have any, and here's one laying up there, what are you going to do? You're going to grab it.
Sure.
So don't tell me it's, I wouldn't do this. Okay, darling.
You're making me want to check all my stories with you now.
I know.
There was another story we had. Of the looting in the riots.
Mm-hmm.
There was just another story that, you know, in the midst of the looting, in the middle of the riots, people stealing stuff, taking stuff. Two cases of liquor were brought to a house, and the people that lived in the house said, no, we don't want that. Two police officers show up. They'll say, hey, we'll take it into the trunk of their car.
I can see that happen.
Okay.
And I can also see. Can you visualize this? I know a 4 stores on Joseph Avenue. Heights of the riot, all during the riot, were never touched.
Why?
Because they treated people people who lived up in that area knew that these people treated them very well. Max Freeland. I could see Max standing in front of his store now, and I said, Max, here, I'll go bother you. He says, I know what Charlie. He says, but I got to be here.
Mm-hmm.
What's the name of the meat place? Cohen's. They never bothered Cohen's.
Mangione's store.
Hmm?
The Mangione's store.
That was over farther there, right?
Okay.
See, that was over 3 or 4 streets.
Too far
over.
Okay.
Yeah, that was over towards St. Paul Street.
Okay.
No, they wouldn't touch Mr. Mangione. I was kid him, even Chuck. When I was walking Clarissa Street, Chuck was only 13 years old. And he wanted to come in the pit side to play. I said, no, Chuck, you can't come in. Out.
Mm-hmm.
Father came up to me. I'm here with him. I said, okay, as long as you're here with Mr. Mangione, you can come in. But other than that, he can't come in. I kid him every time I see him.
Mm-hmm.
I said, remember, I wouldn't let you in the door.
Sorry.
And get. I know Gap.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, as I say, those 4 or 5 stores, never touched.
So the stores that are,
Even liquor stores. Now, yeah, Louis Lipschitz's place. Never touched. Cotton Club. Never touched. Little Harlem. What the heck was it? Just can't think of his name. In the gas station right next door. Never touched.
It's a discriminating mob.
They knew the ones at stores who had treated them unfairly. I use that word.
Mm-hmm. Were those stores hit first?
I would say so.
Okay.
I would say so.
When people
actually,
are...
Actually, right. The breaking in and looting really didn't start about, I would say almost 4 o'clock in the morning, 4 to 5 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Because they turned over Bill's car.
Right.
And all, and then they had to clear the streets and all that. So it was really later time that the so-called rioting or breaking into stores took place.
Okay. What would you call it if not rioting?
It was a riot. My estimation of riot is, you know, they're fighting somebody back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fighting you. We're
sure.
Rioting together.
Sure.
Against each other.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're breaking into a store and just taking out something like that, you're looting. You're taking revenge out on that store, but you're not hurting an individual.
Okay.
You're hurting an individual, but not physically.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a feeling I could sit here and talk to you all night, Mr. Price, but I probably ought to let the two of you get on with your evening.
Oh, you got nothing. See, we're midnight people.
Oh, good Lord. I'm in bed by 10 o'clock every night.
Really?
Oh, Lord.
I have a 4-year-old son. I'm up at 6 a.m. every morning, too.
I never go to bed before 1 o'clock.
I'm on that kind of schedule. Are there things, before we wrap up, are there things that I have failed to ask you about that you think are central to understanding this period? Are there things I've missed?
Mm-mm. Very good.
Mm-mm. Thank you.
I would have to tell you that I was, as I said, I was working for about 2 or 3 different departments.
Okay.
Because you see,
in
the Army, I was in Army Intelligence.
Okay, you failed to mention that.
I know. And then when I came back here and started going to the police department, I was still in Army Intelligence, and then I went into the Justice Department and wanted me to work with them.
Mm-hmm.
So when they had the riots around the country, they'd call me and they'd go, see, I got called to Newark.
Tell me.
And the Newark riots.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the time when we were, I was coming back here to Rochester. Now, I have been in Newark. I called Bill Bumbart.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Bill, Nassau Street tonight, by the Sibley warehouse, Sibley trucking place, sir. We're going to have races. When I say races, I'm going to have drag races.
Drag races, sure.
I said, there may be a little problem. I'm calling from Newark. Well, that must be about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Okay. I catch a plane. It must be about 7 or 8 o'clock to come back here. I get off the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Policeman is standing at this. At the center, well, he wasn't a policeman. He was Bill's administrator.
Assistant.
Was at the airport. She's come to pick me up. They say you got to get down to Joseph Avenue and Nassau Street right away. They're starting a riot.
This is 67.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm saying I called him and told him that. He didn't believe me. Now I'm supposed to go to the riot. I said, look. Tell them I'll be down as soon as I can. I've got to take my wife home. She's got the car here. I'll take her home and I'll get down there. Now we go. We go on Scottsville Road because
mm-hmm.
I'm going mm-hmm. to take Elmwood Avenue home.
Sure.
I get to Scottsville Bridge. Scottsville, the old bridge that goes over the canal. Sheriff's officer there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't come into the city of Rochester. Why? Rioting down there. No kidding. Turn around and go back. Okay. I have to reach my pocket. Captain Bright, I didn't know that was you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got to just take my wife home. I'm going down there. Okay, but here I'm stopped again. So don't I tell you about different stories. I can tell you a million different stories.
How do you not become bitter?
I don't know. It's my nature, I guess. She says I smile at everything.
He doesn't get angry about anything.
He just lets it go, really. Hmm? He just really lets it go. Do you get angry?
Oh, yes.
Come on now, let her answer something.
Yes, I do.
I mean, you're sitting in the car. You're stopped twice on the way home.
Well, I can't say that I would get angry with that. I might have had some fear, you know. But the anger wouldn't have really been there. And just being afraid of them having a riot and then them having to be involved in it.
Right.
You know.
Did these issues of race ever make you angry?
Yeah, it does. But they've gotten better, so, you know, hopefully over the years they'll continue to get better.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I really don't understand how people feel the way they do about other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you remember a particular incident that really got under your skin?
I guess nothing really. Just like I said, you know, I think it, when I was applying for a job in the office, I think that was a racial thing. And there have been times when, you know, people look at you and ignore you or don't wait on you when they should and things like that. But other than that, I've been very fortunate. I know when I was a teenager, I used to go to Virginia because that's where my parents are from. Mm-hmm. And I went to the store to get some ice cream. And I'm standing here at the counter and the freezer is here and the door is open so I can see the ice cream. And I said to the man, I want some ice cream. He says, we don't have any. I said, yes, you do. No, you, no, I don't. Yes, you do. No, I don't. Something told me to be quiet, you know, and I walked out. And then another time, my cousin and I, we were in Virginia, and we went in to get some ice cream at another, like a soda fountain place, at a long counter. And we walked in, and it was like this, you know, an L shape, and the man was standing down here, so we walked down and asked for some ice cream cone. And he says, step down there. And I thought it was just going to be closer for him.
Right. But
then I realized that we would not be served here. We had to go down here to be served. But the crazy thing, when we got ready to leave, the sheriff was there and he held the door open for us. I said, this place is really crazy. But there have been, you know, the things, little things like that. Fortunately, haven't had any big things, bad things to happen.
Sure.
A lot of little small things.
Sure.
Then you hear from other people too. You know?
Okay. So if you were thinking about people that live here in Rochester, people that were around during this period of time, who would you recommend that we talk to?
That are living now?
There's very few.
We can't talk to the dead.
Yeah, I know, there's very few. There's very few. I don't know. You talked to Connie already?
We did. Connie and John both.
You just mentioned a name. That goes back into that story that I told you about. I'm going to say which one.
Okay.
Really, there's not too many people, because even like the people you're talking to now, like Connie Mitchell and Johnny, they came here
right
about the time of the riots.
Yep.
And then we've got a lot of people who came here, I would say, after 1947, 48.
Mm-hmm.
But now you read in the paper or somebody does an interview with them, they know all about Rochester.
Right.
So the historians of Rochester. And I said, oh, Lord, shake my head. Mm-hmm. Oh, Freddie mm-hmm. Jenkins, but Freddie wouldn't come here. I know better than that.
What about Reverend Thurman?
Well, he didn't get here. Come here to in his 60s, 50s, 60s.
When was he here? Mm-hmm. When did he come here?
I was here about at the time of the up at Colgate Divinity School.
So late 60s.
Yeah, he was in the late 50s.
Late 50s he comes, or late 60s?
50s.
I would like to talk to him.
Yeah, with Reverend Thurman.
Mm-hmm. I'd be really interested in talking to him.
Charles Thurman.
Charles, right, because you have the same name.
Somewhere here in the city.
Okay.
But I can't think of any.
So many of them are gone.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to tell you, when Irene Ingram said that she went to church with you, as she suggested, Irene suggested that we get up with you.
Oh, my God. I remember when she came here, too.
Yeah?
Yes, oh, yes.
They, the two of them crack me up. They are one funny couple.
He
did. Mm-hmm. Oh, the 29th. I meant to give him a call, and I forgot. July 29th.
Hey, youngster.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So they all actually suggested that I try to get with you two, and I'm so glad that I did.
See, I'm only 85.
You are not. Well, you would have to be.
I'm 85.
You know, when you said, oh my God, when you said you joined the police force in 47, I thought, he can't have that right. I was trying to do the math real quick, but I couldn't pay attention and do the math, so I stopped doing the math. Are you really 85? Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
I'm not, but he is.
Mm-hmm. Yep, born and raised in all Rottenchester, as I say. She gives me having to call her Rottenchester.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow, that is impressive. Well, we have one last thing we want to ask you to do.
Cool.
We have a set of pictures here, and we were hoping that you would look at them and see if you can tell us anybody that you recognize in them. They are,
they're great. Some of them are great photos. They might bring you back a couple years.
I probably don't even say it, don't even know.
Do you want buildings and stuff identified?
Well, Pete, let's go. We don't have time.
We don't have a lot of time. And you know specifically. Let me let her do this because she knows a little better.
Not necessarily. But these are newspapers.
Well, I need to know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you happen to,
we would like to try to
send a general crisis maybe because I want to try to get up with the
police.
But Irene and Claire invited me, and so I thought I would do that instead. Yeah, please. If you know anybody.
Who are
these two other black officers?
Is it Jimmy Bird? No, it's Cooper.
That's Cooper.
It's Cooper, and it's Asher.
Okay. All right, fine. We've got the
black officers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Neither of those is alive.
George Cooper's not himself in Asher.
Would they be good for him?
I'm sure, George. I know Asher, I don't know about George, but Asher, yeah.
Would be
both
good.
Here.
Okay.
John is a guard for, is a security guard for Wiggins.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Now, see, George was raised here in Rochester. He knows all these guys too. George is no more. Because he's raised here in Rochester. I know who that is too.
But this one is Ashford.
Yeah, it's Ashford. Yeah, Ashford.
Okay.
And
is he kin to LaFoy, Ashford? Do you know?
LaFoy? Mm-hmm. LaFoy? Lady? Lady? I remember Lady came here from Mississippi and into my aunt's house when he first came to Rochester. Mm-hmm.
Okay, is it the same Ashford?
Yeah, they're related, but they're cousins.
Yeah, okay.
You don't know where, how we would get in touch with
Cooper? Josh Cooper's in Tubman. They're both in Tubman.
Oh, okay.
Josh Cooper lives in, what was his name? Herman's.
Herman.
I think it's Herman's, the project right there.
Okay, okay, don't give us a call.
Yeah, I can get in touch with him. He's going to be, he and I are going to the VFW together.
Oh. Does Marcus Carson take a job with the police department at some point?
No, he was the head of the human relations department.
I knew that.
County of Monroe.
But I thought I saw, I thought I had read somewhere that he took a different position after that.
Mm-hmm. He was state troopers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, he did.
Yeah, his wife was still there.
She's still there. Mm-hmm. She's out of now.
History.
Was she active?
Marge? Not that much, I don't think. No, I know who it is, but I can't think of his name. I know who it is. That's Jerry Camarty. See here, the other holes. See, it took me by the holes. It wasn't.
Yeah.
See, it's because he was couldn't have been. I thought it was Al Joseph, but it was not. Because Al Joseph wouldn't even have been. Because I did the background on Al.
I cannot believe you are 85 years old.
I know.
Does he
brag
about it?
No.
No, you don't act your age.
That's really, really wonderful.
1923.
Oh, that's really wonderful.
You know any of these characters?
Nah.
You wouldn't say you didn't. You know every single one of them.
Oh, he's mad.
That's close to bed.
Yeah.
Let's see if I can get here. Let's see if I can get here. It's a furniture store.
Oh, what?
Wait,
let me get to here where I can write it. Suskins. Is that Suskins? Which is furniture?
No, Suskins is a paint store. And here's another one that was never touched.
Same thing?
Mm-hmm. Because Suskin hired a lot of black people to work in his little store.
Mm-hmm.
How did you marry?
Well, through Clarence. Boy, he is a character. I don't know how she's done that all those years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the two of them are hysterical. Well, you know, I called him up.
Oh, you knew him?
Nope.
Oh.
There was a piece on him in the paper.
Oh, yeah.
I think there was a piece on you in the paper, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I told you we had.
Yeah.
Was it also Mark Hare?
Yeah, Mark.
Did
mm-hmm.
he?
Mm-hmm.
I have to go back and I thought that was true. I like Mark Hare.
He's very good.
So
he
much.
Very good.
He finds good people in life. He gives you hope. In a world that's mm-hmm. got a lot of evil in it.
So we just called Mr. Ingram up. And, he was quite willing to talk. And boy, that man has stories.
Really?
Some excellent, excellent stories.
This is down at Buchanan Park. Well, the one I know where he's on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Herman Street runs off of this way. Here, so that would be those two Baden Street, and it'll be down to here.
Mm. Did you know anybody in Corning?
Oh, yeah.
The Kramers?
That's Kramer?
Mm-hmm. Boy, the Kramers, they're all over Corning and Campbell Bowl.
His wife was a gym teacher at a school, and his father was a coach at school, Dutch Sherman Kramer.
Coach Kramer. You know, my dad went to West High School in Corning.
You got to know him, man.
And I feel like I have heard that name at the kitchen table before.
Yeah. and Pops Holmes, the Holmes family. He was a big star player, basketball player down there.
I don't know Holmes. Dad played football. He just had his 45th class reunion.
He just had our
66. He lives in Bath now. But he grew up in Corning, and we lived in Savona when I was growing up.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And you lived a year on Castlebar?
I lived a year on Castlebar. I was just renting a room there, actually. Gosh, I was working on my... Well, it was a very strange...
Oh, this is Bronson Avenue. I wonder. Mm-hmm. This is Bronson.
Now, you said this is McCullough Street now? McCree.
McCree Boulevard.
Yeah. McCree Boulevard, okay.
Where is the street?
This is, what we've got is the original and then the duplicate. So, mm-hmm. What about these? Oh, yeah.
Is that guard?
Boy, I've got here a couple of things here. Which one? Second from right. That one, is that right? Or no, maybe no. That one.
That's Christina there. There was Lou, he worked for me, can't think of his name.
And this one, they've got Asher identified. Maybe there. How could they?
Well, because he's one of the old lighthouses, mm-hmm. So he was
probably, yeah. Anybody else?
Mr. Price, can you tell me about it?
It's in the basement. And we have a couch on there. There's a pillow and a blanket.
You just live down the refrigerator, maybe?
There's a freezer down there. It's small.
Look at the original and see if you can get a better base at all.
It's not a river, yeah. There's got to be somebody back there. Can we go there? Would be probably even out of there?
No.
All these people.
No.
It was Ken Scott, Spencer Walker, Earl Carter. I don't think it was Lloyd. Could that be Lloyd?
About his size.
Yeah, it's about the size for him.
Let me see.
So how many, at the time of the riots, how many black police
were there? 9 or 10.
9 or 10.
There were that many. Wow. That's an excellent question. I didn't think of it.
It might be Lloyd Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
Out of a force of how many?
About 700 some odd at that time.
Good Lord. Oh. There were that many police in Rochester?
I got the records. I kept the records about every year, the number of police officers we had. I had to keep records of them.
Something tells me you have an excellent filing cabinet. It isn't junk, though, really.
How do you know if I told you I had the arrest of every person who was locked up in the riots, their name, their address, birthday, handwritten, beside the court records of every one of them?
What would it cost to?
$1 million for that right now.
Everybody
wants to know about the riots. I laugh when they call me about the riots now because I've got all this information. And I said, well, I just let people run their mouths.
See, I told them you got to write a book.
Yeah, you should.
Well, you should.
It is.
It's on the same side of the street.
Okay.
The same house from my board.
125. What's his favorite kind of dessert? What's his favorite kind of dessert?
Any kind.
Any kind. You prefer pie or cake?
Both.
Okay. I see how this is going to work. 125.
I think the only thing he doesn't like is chocolate cake. Oh, the cake itself.
Yeah, that's the frosting.
Yeah, the chocolate frosting.
My son licks the frosting off the cake and then asks for another piece.
Drives me crazy. No, you can't have another piece. He just wants some frosting.
Just how old is he?
4. And you know, you have to appreciate, he doesn't get a lot of sugar. So it's like, it's a real exciting thing when he has cake.
It's cute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was his birthday. On his birthday. I mean, how do you tell a child no on his birthday?
Oh, no.
Well, I did. Because I didn't want the rest of his birthday ruined because he's in a sugar high coma. I'm reading these with you.
Oh, okay.
And, tomorrow at some point. I think I signed the book.
Okay, thank you. Oh, also, you want to... We would like to have for each of you, just biographical outline. You don't have to follow this. Do you have a name for this gentleman?
I think it's Lloyd Stevens, but I'm not sure.
Well, let's say. Which one's
Stevenson?
Yeah.
Black.
Stevens.
Lloyd Stevens. I can't even tell exactly which
one. Is he still alive?
That one.
Right.
He was on the police force?
Mm-hmm.
Your cousin?
Yeah.
And he's still alive?
Oh, yeah. He's down. No, he's here now.
Yeah.
He is 6 months in Florida, 6 months up here.
Floyd or
Lloyd?
Lloyd.
L-L-Y-O. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well,
I feel made out of
Well, no. know. Laura, S-T-E-V-E-N-S?
S. Let me see here. Those are mine. It was her, what's his name? Alma Burton, Lloyd Stevens, and Jimmy Burton, Lloyd Stevens, and Irv Carter.
Irv Carter. That's the name I've heard. Mm-hmm.
I don't think Chitsey was on at that time. Yeah, Chitsey was working then. Walker. It's Kenneth Scott.
Kenneth Scott.
He's dead. Likely,
that name's unfamiliar to me. I feel like I know more dead people than I do.
Who's one of them? They lived on Bronson Avenue.
Oh, Scott.
The other Scott. Gene Scott.
Chandler.
Gus Newport, he was in Marcus.
Marcus Alexis.
And I know Mark Alexis.
And Bernie Gifford. All four of them are out in the Bay Area now.
Yeah, but Gus was here Sunday.
Yeah.
That's your
home. He's at church with his mother.
No!
He's coming back.
When?
Clarice
Street reunion, I think.
Oh, I desperately want to talk to him.
Okay, I'll get your phone number at home.
I'll tell you how badly I want to talk to him and the others. I'm trying to get a plane ticket to California to meet up with these people. But if he's going to be here, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, if he said he was leaving.
Janice Prescott.
He was leaving and coming back because he's helping New Orleans rebuild.
Do you know when he's coming back?
No.
Clarissa's
coming back. I think he'll be back for the Clarissa Street reunion. He usually comes back to take his mother down the street all the time.
When is that? When is it held?
16th of August. All right. On a Saturday. Is that the 16th of August, a Saturday?
It is.
Where's Janice?
I didn't see that right here. Right here, is it Janice?
The second from the right?
So what you gonna do with that paperwork, Mr. Grace?
What paperwork?
The paperwork you're hoarding there in your house.
I have some good pictures. What do you want? Pictures from Malcolm X Colgan Divinity School?
In all seriousness, I would love to look at them. I really would. I'm back here August 20th and 21st. I would love to look at that stuff.
Your water's here, girl.
Yeah, this allergy's killing me.
You know, I have trouble certain times of year, never this time of year. I have trouble this year.
Oh, they was on TV, they said this has been the worst year for allergies.
I think that's probably right. Okay, here. I'll tell you, I'm in the process of writing an article about Malcolm in Rochester.
Write your name and tell them how long you have to get it.
And,
did you know Gus Newport?
No.
Oh,
he's a name that's come up over and over. Gus Newport was just here on Sunday.
Oh, he's at church.
Oh, gosh. But he's apparently coming back. Coming back, he's like,
there you go.
Okay.
Thank you, man.
I heard that his mother, maybe used to.
She's still alive.
She's still.
She's 90-something. She's in the Presbyterian home on Thurston Road.
Oh, so she's actually old, not like you guys.
Wow.
good.
Aye.
He ought to be getting some royalties.
Use it what you want filled out, right?
Yeah.
And as I say, you don't, what we would like to do is to be able to have a little biographical sketch of you. And so just fill out what you would like that would characterize you. And if there's more that you wish to say than that's fine.
Steve McCloskey.
And don't be shy about putting, you know.
Well, there's not much about me.
Well, you mentioned two positions.
Well, after coming out, and then
I'm not sure.
That's what I said. I had a picture of my grandfather's store.
Very cool.
In Calvin, and he had a store in 1925. And I've been trying to find a date. I got the date, but I can't get to you. How many times? This here was the Valais Radio Shop. Right, Vallette, V-A-L-E-T, did he spell it, Vallette? Radio shop, TV and radio shop. His father was one shot that guy over on Joseph Avenue in the liquor store, remember? Mm-hmm. At the store, radio store, and the guys kept breaking in, and he rigged the alarm and guns shot. And he shot. When the guy broke in, boom, we never got charged for it. Yeah.
And it's that building right there. Mm-hmm. Chuck, are you sure that's right? Because the Gibson house, and then what was next door to
the annex. The annex was that little one next door. This is the big one that had the porch. Downstairs, the Pitha, or not the Pitha, but the Masonic had their place downstairs we used to go to. Mm-hmm.
See, you remember it going up.
And this is where Smitty had his barbecue place, right in the corner there. Because this is Edinburgh Street here.
And Edinburgh down, Street here? Yeah,
and going down to the other, what's, yeah, it was Edinburgh going down, who was it?
Edinburgh, and then it
was Heron. Heron, that's right.
This is Edinburgh then?
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of anybody who had this store in the corner. Here's Vlatz's over here, Paul. But that store right in the corner. You had to go up little stairs to go into it.
Yeah. I used to go there all the time. When I was in school.
Yeah.
Ice cream.
That's right in the corner, Tremont.
I like ice cream. I like your house.
She's got it in the house right now.
I heard a lot of stories about ice cream from you tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
What
do you mean? That's right.
Yeah, this is
like the writer.
Remember Sizer, don't you? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is that the woman who said?
Yeah, they said it's Sizer.
Was she a
nice looking hat, so that's it.
Seems like anyone is taking it. You can drop some of the smokestacks. Yeah, the cars the street.
That looks to me.
We're looking towards the tree, it's got to be looking.
What? Can we pause there. Three quarters?
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry.
Not bad.
I didn't
it doesn't know. Matter. Well, we do more than pause at this point. I think we stop.